भगवते वासुदेवाय। रीडिंग फ्रॉम कैंटो 5 चैप्टर 11 एंटाइटल्ड जड़ भरत इंस्ट्रक्ट्स किंग रहुगुण टेक्स्ट 10 धाकृति स्पर्श रस श्रवांसी विसर्गरति अर्ति अभिजल्प शिल्पः एकादशं स्वीकरणं ममेति शय्याम् अहं द्वादशम् एक आहु। ट्रांसलेशन प्रपोर्ट बाय हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस श्रील प्रभुपाद। Translation, sound, touch, form, taste and smell are the objects of the five knowledge acquiring senses. Speech, touch, movement, evacuation and sexual intercourse are the objects of the working senses. Besides this, there is another conception by which one thinks, this is my body, this is my society, this is my family, this is my nation, and so forth. This 11th function, that of the mind, is called the false ego. According to some philosophers, this is the 12th function and its field of activity is the body. Purport. There are different objects for the 11 items. Through the nose we can smell, by the eyes we can see, by the ears we can hear, and in this way we gather knowledge. Similarly, there are the karmendriyas, the working senses, the hands, legs, genitals, rectum, mouth and so forth. When the false ego expands, it makes one think, this is my body, family, society, country, etc. We are continuing to read and understand the beautiful instructions of the self-realized pure devotee, Jad Bharat Maharaj, as he is instructing his disciple, the surrendered soul, Maharaj Rahuguna. And right now, in his explanation and his teachings, Jad Bharat is now delving upon the analysis, something like Sankhya, making Rahuguna understand the elements which constitute material nature. So, in today's sloka, he is explaining how there are five working senses and five knowledge acquiring senses, Karmendriya and Gnanendriyas, and how each and every sense which is there, has got its definitive sense corresponding object, which it is always trying to get in touch with, get in contact with, always very much exposed to receiving the impulses to satisfy it, like a receptor, like you have a receptor, always eager to receive stimuli. So the senses are receiving impulses from the environment. Eyes are receiving visual inputs of various colors and forms. The ears are receiving sound vibration of various frequencies. The touch is looking forward to touch various types of objects of various textures. The tongue is trying to vibrate and taste various types of tastes. And we can see that there are so many varieties in this world, And because there are unlimited varieties in this world, the senses are always, always, in a sense, in a mood of being agitated to keep on receiving these inputs. And that is the conception of happiness in this world. Samsparshaja bhoga. Krishna explains that the whole concept of happiness in this world is when the sparsha takes place, when the object and that sense get in contact, there is sparsha. There is some neuronal stimulation. And because of that, there is a feeling of happiness. It is a grossly physical phenomena with absolutely no spiritual substance whatsoever. It is a gross activity only on a very gross corporeal platform of the object and the senses interacting. And then producing, you can actually record it on the oscilloscope. You can do this phenomenon of you throw some light on the eyes and you put the probes in the back portion of your brain, the occipital area, and you see that particular lobe starts vibrating because it is receiving some input. So it's a very gross activity. And then Jadabhat Maharaj is not wanting to stop discussing at that level, but he's taking him deeper to understand that all these activities of the senses are governed by somebody else. They themselves are not the governors. Yesterday Madan Gopal Prabhu gave a very Sankhya type lecture, very analytical, powerful lecture. He must be having great intellectual prowess to think like that. Very impressive. But he's now going one step further and saying all this is governed by a very subtle element called the false ego. He's a governor. He's the overall governor of all these karmendriyas and gnaniendriyas. So the evolution of discussion is from gross towards showing the subtle aspects of reality and how what appears to be a control of the gross senses is actually control of the subtle elements. And Jada Maharaj, Bharat Maharaj will take further the discussion and try to focus on the false ego. We have been made to understand that in material nature, as things become more subtle, they become more powerful. Gross things are also powerful, but not as powerful as subtle. Like in warfare, we have been made to understand that how the modern warfare is very gross, and therefore it can break buildings and destroy things like that. But in previous times, they had subtle warfare, subtle weapons, based on sound. Now they are based only on earth and fire. But we can see that among the elements of material nature, you have earth is very, very gross. Very gross, absolutely gross. It has all the five qualities. And then you have water. Then you have fire, becomes more subtle. Less and less, becomes more powerful. Then you have air, which the element of vision just goes away. That is eliminated. It's more powerful, less sensual input. You can't see air, but more powerful than even fire. Then you have ether, which contains all these elements. Therefore, it is even more powerful. And sound travels through that. Very powerful. Sound. It's a mightier than the sword. Right? Sound. When somebody writes his thoughts, then it has been written by a pen, which is very gross. But the sound vibration coming out from that pen can destroy nations. Because it is the input of a subtle element. And then as you go even further down, from the sthul deha to the sukshma deha, we have mind illness and false ego, which is even far more subtle. And we know how powerful the mind is. The main reason why mind is so powerful is because of its subtlety. If it were to be something very gross, it won't be so powerful. But it is so subtle, therefore it is extremely powerful. And then you have the most subtle element, that is false ego. Therefore, it is explained in the sections on creation that how the whole creation takes place from the most subtle element, which is false ego. Mahatattva, which is the most subtle element of creation, first gets transformed into false ego. And from then, all the gross elements come. Now, if we analyze the various processes of self-realization, then we can also see that they actually deal with these different elements. So one level you have the karmakanda process, which is a very gross process. And you have the jnana yoga process, which is subtle, dealing with knowledge. And then even more subtle is the ashtanga yoga process, far more subtle, where you try to control the airs of the body. You do pranayama, and this will influence subtle elements, functionings of your body. Control all the different samana, vayana, udana, vayana, all these areas you control. And through that you try to control the powerful mind. But we can see that all these processes of self-realization are trying to actually achieve the goal of self-realization. But we find that the most powerful approach towards self-realization is not karma kanda, jnana yoga or karma yoga, but actually is bhakti. Why? Why is bhakti more powerful than other processes? Because it is a most subtle process. Because it does not deal with just gross senses or even the mind or even the intelligence. Actually, bhakti yoga attacks the very source of the problem. When you have a disease, if you can focus on where actually the problem actually is, like somebody has a fever, the fever is all over his body, not only on his head or only in his stomach. The fever is all over the body. But you have to really focus, the doctor has to focus, which organ is the fever coming from? Oh, this is coming from his kidneys. So he focuses on just one organ. And then he attacks the organ with powerful antibiotics. And when he hits that organ, then the entire body is free from fever. So the process is to actually focus on the very source. So this sloka explains so beautifully that all these things are going on, karmendra, gyanendra function is going on. But what really is the focus of the problem is not the senses and the mind. The focus of the problem is the false ego, ahankara. Therefore, any process which can manipulate, modify, transform, change and effect the false ego is bound to be the most powerful process. Which process is there among all the processes which are being offered through the Vedas which attacks the false ego? It's like the bullseye. What attacks the false ego is bound to be the most powerful. Because you make that change at the most subtle level, you make a big change, massive change. Also in diseases, we see this, not only in warfare, but even in disease, we can see that even though we know that the body, for example, has got so many systems, the respiratory system, it's got a digestive system, cardiovascular system, musculoskeletal system, so many systems are there, but, and most people would like to think that these are all very important systems, but if I were to ask you, which among all these or otherwise is the most important system in the body? What would you say? Which is the most important system? Anybody knows the answer? Nervous system. Endocrinal system. You can see we are getting subtle answers now. I mentioned only five gross systems and they said nervous system is far more subtle. Because nervous energy is electrical energy. Little energy cannot be seen. You can see the blood, but you cannot see electrical energy. You can see your heart, you can see your kidneys, but you cannot perceive. Every nervous system is based on electrical impulses coming from the brain. Every nerve is basically a generator of electrical impulse. Therefore, it's subtle. And you have, as you mentioned, the endocrine system. It's very subtle. And we can see that it is so powerful, for example, endocrine system, that even though just a small amount of hormone is produced, just a small amount, this goes in nanograms, Now we eat food. Now how much food we eat? Of course, we eat in grams, sometimes kilos. It's very, very gross type of, input into the body to allow it to function and this and that, various things. But how much hormones are released? When we evaluate them in our laboratories, we calculate them in terms of nanograms. So grams, micrograms, then you have picograms and nanograms, like that. It's very subtle. Just few nanograms is released and makes the whole body move in various ways. And that is not there. It's more or less, it can create big effects. But most doctors, probably the entire medical fraternity is not aware that the most powerful system in the body is the immunological system. It is the one which controls all other systems. If the immunological system breaks down, the nervous system breaks down, the endocrine system breaks down, everything just breaks down. Therefore, the most difficult disease to manage in the world is AIDS. Why? Why is AIDS more difficult than heart attacks and kidney failures and all sorts of diseases which are there, millions of diseases. But the most difficult disease I don't think they'll ever find a cure for this, is AIDS disease. Why? Because it is destruction by the virus of the most powerful system, the immunological system. Human immunodeficiency virus, HI, I stands for immunodeficiency. So it just creates a complete deficiency of immunity in your body. So if your heart is very strong, you're an athletic person, but the heart will crumble down. Your powerful muscles, but they will crumble down. Your teeth are very strong, but they get infected. You have powerful digestion, but you'll start getting tumors in your stomach because the immunity is destroyed. So we can see that it is a very subtle system, immunity. Very subtle system. The immunological function takes place at such a small microscopic level. In fact, it is at the cellular level. But it is the most powerful system. It governs everything. Therefore, the Chinese say that if somebody can have powerful immunity, he becomes immortal. People only die because their immunology system is getting withered out with age. People don't die because of heart attacks or all this actually is a decline of the immunological system. So those medicines are also most effective as a corollary, as a logic, which actually affect the immunity of the person. So those drugs which destroy immunity destroy the body, and those drugs which promote immunity are the best drugs to have, the best medicines to have in nature. So like we have, for example, we use steroids in medical practice. All of you have heard of the word steroids. Now why is steroids such a powerful drug? Because it directly affects immunological functions. Therefore it is so powerful. It can make massive changes in the immunity of the person. So the point I'm trying to make is that if we are able to manipulate the subtle most energy in the body or in creation, then we can have the most powerful effects which you want to actually create. So we can see that all other systems of self-realization are often a failure unless there is a touch of bhakti. Therefore, Prabhupada explains clearly that even if the Jnana Yoga process has to become effective, it has to have an add of bhakti. Same with Ashtanga Yoga also. Because just a pure Ashtanga Yogi, pure, is like we have pure devotional service, you have pure, somebody like a pure Ashtanga Yogi, like that, unalloyed Ashtanga Yogi, we can see he is not actually successful. And the actual, you can say, fight of the titans in one sense, big, huge titans. One, you have Durvasa Muni and you have Maharaj Ambarish. Powerful personalities. What is the power of Durvasa Muni? He's a pure, unalloyed Ashtanga Yogi. Very powerful. What is the level of his achievements in Siddha Yoga? He can go to Vaikuntha also with mantras. Can anybody do that in the modern world? They can create some ash and some ling and some cloth and some watches. It was very insignificant, stupid type of magic. But somebody can actually fly to Vaikuntha, Shivaloka, Brahmaloka, in no time. unbelievable. But even though so powerful, he had not been able to effect a change in that element which is the cause of all bondage, which is the false ego. His false ego had not been tackled. He had intellectual prowess, mental prowess, tremendous mystic prowess, but no access to actually subduing, destroying and purifying his false ego. Therefore, he was a failure in front of Ambarish Maharaj, who was seemingly otherwise powerful, but he did not use any weapons. But he was defeated. Durasamani was defeated by the devotional energy emanating from Maharaj Ambarish. Here is a person who has got no mystic power, not even carrying a sword in his hand, no defense whatsoever, but he's without even offering a fight to Durvasamuni, defeats Durvasamuni. Why? By the power of his devotion. Why? Because he has actually changed his false ego completely. By the power of his devotion, he has understood that actually, I'm not supposed to offer a fight to this great Brahman Rishi. Mare Krishna Rakhya Ke. He just surrenders to Krishna. So, the conclusion we can safely draw is that bhakti is so glorious because it attacks the false ego. And therefore, the most important verse in the scripture, among all the scriptural injunctions, teachings, vast millions of things which are given for people to understand, but the most powerful sloka ever written or spoken in creation is Trinadapi Sunichena sloka. Why is it the most powerful sloka in existence? Because it actually hits the very problem, which is false ego. So anybody who has conquered false ego is by definition the most powerful person in creation. Not the person who has got weapons or missiles or tanks and computers like that. But because if somebody has subdued false ego, he has subdued all material existence. He has subdued all material energy. He has subdued the Mahatattva also, the source of the false ego. He is beyond material energy. So that personality who has that shakti, by dint of his devotion to modify and destroy his false ego, is the most powerful person there can ever be. And therefore Srila Prabhupada was so powerful. He had no power of speech in the sense of being a very charismatic speaker. He had no other power of money. Most movements have money power, and therefore they have big temples and a lot of followers and big propaganda because they have money power. And they can attract. It's like a business. You have more money, you invite more money into a business, you can get more input. You can buy the product, you can sell it better. Even if it is a stupid product, you can sell it better if you have put a lot of money in advertisement. So those moments where money power, they massively propagate and they get a lot of followers. But Prabhupada had no money power, nothing whatsoever, no followers. But he had subdued his false ego completely. There was no existence of false ego, even to the microscopic extent, in the being of his divine grace. And therefore, actually, he could very effortlessly say, "My dear Lord, I am puppet in your hands. Make me dance, make me dance, make me dance." This is an expression of a person, only a person who has got no false ego to the limits can only speak like this. We can sing, but we cannot feel like this. We cannot feel like this. It would take millions of years of purification to actually feel like this, being completely free from false ego. And if we extend the discussion even further, we said bhakti yoga is most powerful. But then the question can be asked, why is bhakti yoga most powerful? Because it attacks the false ego, yes. But then why is bhakti yoga able to attack the false ego? Because bhakti yoga is the direct energy of the most powerful person that ever exists. That is Srimati Radharani. Radharani is the embodiment of the internal energy that is bhakti. She is bhakti swarupini. She is the embodiment of all bhakti. So her personal shakti, it's like a soul, the shakti of a warrior is his sword or his bow and arrow. is his shakti, is his weapons, the way he fights his enemy. So also Radharani's personal shakti is bhakti, her bhakti towards Krishna. And because she has the highest level of bhakti, she's the embodiment of bhakti, she's a personification of bhakti, she's like a person who has a monopoly on bhakti, practically. All bhakti we say, whichever exists in anybody, we see any devotee whatsoever, he only has a fragmental portion of the unlimited reservoir of bhakti, which is Srimati Radharani. So with that vast, if you have a Prabhu person like Prabhupada, who's so powerful, but you imagine, and he's getting a shakti from Srimati Radharani in that sense. Imagine Radharani herself, who is the very source of bhakti, how powerful she is. She's unlimitedly powerful. In fact, because of her power, she can even subdue the most powerful Krishna. The power of her bhakti. So, because that Radharani is the source of bhakti, that is why bhakti is so powerful. Therefore, the bhakti yoga process is so powerful. Therefore, everything which enhances bhakti is so powerful because it hits the false ego. And therefore, among all the various teachings of the acharyas, we can see the most important teaching which the spiritual master is endeavoring to give his disciples on path of bhakti is to teach them again and again and again and again, repeatedly, almost hammering this concept that there is no glory in being a big devotee. There is no glory in being an advanced devotee. There is no glory in being a flashy devotee, a powerful manager or a powerful leader who can conquer nations and give big lectures and have millions of followers. That is not projected in ISKCON movement as a success story. Because there have been people on that platform of being continental conquerors, but ultimately losing to the false ego. Because the biggest virus against false ego is pride. When that element of pride enters, it can destroy even bhakti. At least temporarily. It cannot destroy permanently, but at least temporarily it can efface away the effects of bhakti. Therefore, people with the heights of devotional achievements have become insignificant puppets of material energy because of the infection of pride. And the only weapon against pride, the only antidote to pride, which is the biggest enemy of the practicing devotee, is humility. Like you have antidotes, you have poison. You have a poison, you take a snake poison, then you have ASV, anti-snake venom. So you are bitten by a cobra, then you give anti-cobra venom. So then this thing is destroyed. You take Bagon spray or Tick 20, for people take it all the time for dying and frustration. Then you find an antidote, and then you keep injecting that antidote, and the effect of Tick 20 is destroyed in the body, and again, patient becomes healthy. So also, our biggest problem is pride, born out of false ego. You think that I am the body, I am the enjoyer, I am this, I am a great devotee, I am a great this, I am a great that, whatever. So that is our false ego. And we can see all of us have that abundantly. We are not able to, feel like I am just Krishna's servant like that. We have it in us. So, to the antidote for that pride of false, coming from false ego, is this humility. And therefore, among all our cultivating practices, anushilanam, among all of our cultivations, we are trying to cultivate this quality, that quality, this quality, that quality. But the most important quality we are asked to cultivate diligently, scrutinizingly, and to its professional level is humility. Is humility. And we can see those leaders, of course, they don't even want to be leaders. When you have humility, you don't want to be a leader. It's just the opposite. It's quite an amazing phenomenon. Then you have the most powerful person fit to be a leader, but you think, I'm just a nothing. So those practices of humility automatically emerge. They're not appointed leaders. Those people who possess this quality of humility don't have to be appointed as leaders ever. They just are like self-manifested leaders. And we can see the most successful people in any spiritual movement will only be those people, and it will be long-lasting. Short-term success can be brought about by false ego. But long-lasting devotion and dying also with that quality will only be possible to those who have inculcated this very powerful sentiment of humility of the heart. Therefore, at the time of Diksha itself, the process of humility training starts the time of Diksha. Therefore, the very first thing you are told when you take Diksha is that you are, your name is Madan Mohan, and the first, most important, as they say, is the word Das. As it was being explained, that we all are very eager to know what is my name. What will be my, that transcendental name by which I will be called henceforth till I die. Which type of Das or Devi Dasi? Will it be Madan Mohan Das or Murari Das or this Das, that Das? And my name is from V, so it's Vanamali Das and Vras Sundar Das. And you're just thinking like that. You know, everyone is wanting to have a nice name. And that's a major part of the excitement. Somebody says, Prabhuji, I got initiated today. I said, what is your name? The first thing is, you know, we ask, what is your name? Says, my name is Vanamali. But as is explained to us by the initiating spiritual master, that the most important word is not that. That's just to differentiate the one Das from the other Das. That's the only way it is given. Otherwise, everyone is Krishna Das. But then if you call everybody Krishna Das, then you don't know whom are you calling. So only for reasons of practical dealing, you have to call one person as Vanamali and the person as Vrasundar. But ultimately, the most important word which we are taught we are to learn is the word Das. And we very conveniently forget that. that is what I'm supposed to be. I'm Vrasundar Das. So that training is the very first serious surrender with the spiritual master, where a person on one side he takes vows, and the spiritual master gives him his true identity. I'm giving you access to understand your true identity. If you follow this process, I'm giving you this mantra also. We can also understand logically through this discussion that why is this mantra most powerful? Because this mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra, is a mantra which actually, and Acharyas have explained so beautifully, that this mantra actually means, my dear Lord, please engage me in your devotional service. So, the false ego says, you are the enjoyer. The dictation on the false ego is that you are enjoyer. That is like the preeminent emotion in our consciousness all the times. It's like the background emotion, the background sense of reality which we have in doing all our activity, devotional and non-devotional many a times, is that I am the, and that's a background understanding. And then we do everything else after that. But while we are cultivating humility, we are being told to keep in the background what emotion? I am the servant. So when that is the background consciousness in all that we do in the external world, then that actually is real devotion, real bhakti. So this, what they call in management, a shift of paradigms, that I'm not the enjoyer, but in fact, we can say I am the enjoyer. We can still say I am the enjoyer. But I can only enjoy provided I serve. I will really have the maximum enjoyment when I really don't bother about it, but just look forward to serving. And therefore, the concept of enjoyment for a devotee becomes a byproduct. With that background activity of being enjoyer, that becomes the most important product we want to achieve. Is it giving me enjoyment? Then I do this devotional service. Otherwise, I don't do it. But for a devotee, actually, who is in proper state of consciousness, enjoyment or pleasure is simply a byproduct which Krishna gives him because of his devotional input, because of his service. He is more focused on service, no matter whether enjoyment comes or not. If it comes by Krishna's grace, it's welcome. I'm satisfied. I'm happy that Krishna is reciprocating. If it does not come, it does not really matter to me. Because my biggest enjoyment is to be offered service. And we'll end the class by giving an example of this. And this was a very powerful lesson which many of us learned at Vrindavan Dham. When actually we were offered this very prestigious service of being the servers to Srila Prabhupada's disciples on his disappearance day. Prasadam serving was offered to Radha Gopinath temple. And his Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj made a very, to my mind, a very startling, very powerful comment at that time. He said, today, this was his opening line, today, the cumulative effect, the cumulative merit of the devotional yatras which we have performed since so many years has achieved fruit. Now, Radha Gopinath temple has been performing yatras for so many years, since 1986. So many years we have gone so many places and performed such devotional activities of kirtan and this and that. So much devotional energy has been, you know, expended out by thousands of devotees during these yatras. But the cumulative effect of that, according to Radhanath Swami, was that we have got a chance now to offer prasad seva to Srila Prabhupada's disciples in Sri Vrindavan Dham. So that was a net result, the resultant fruit. And then he explained to us what is the actual mood of seva. When you actually are offering prasadam to a devotee, you have to treat him like he is your deity. Because Krishna will eat through him. Krishna says, I eat through the mouths of my devotees. And he gave us such a beautiful explanation of how the most advanced devotees in Mahaprabhu's Leela were the ones who were doing the service. Swarup Damodar, and even Lord Chaitanya himself was with handfuls giving away prasadam. Haridas Thakur's disappearance day and many other times, Chidadai festival, like that. So after giving us his background understanding of the glory of prasad seva, then other devotees give other practical details. And in this way, after hearing for about half an hour or so, the glory of this service and the privilege of having had it, everyone was fired up for seva. And everyone was waiting when the line of devotees will come in their row. There were all these rows made by Vasudev Prabhu, B1 and A1 and this and that, all that rows were made. Everyone was waiting when devotees will come to my row. And they would come, and then immediately there is a line and people are offering prasadam and the khichdi, this, that, so many things. Actually, khichdi was not there, sorry. But all these pakwans were there. Various pakwans were there. And then the other team is ready with, you know, the cleanser and the water, and then as soon as I get up, immediately then the place is cleaned, and then you're just waiting when the next batch will come. And just wanting to, eagerly waiting when devotees come to your row so you can serve them. Oh, why are they going to that row? Why don't they come to my row? I can do some seva to them. It wasn't often easy for most of us who have got weak backs. Because in Kali Yuga, one of the weaknesses we have is a weak back. Weak everything, but weak back also. So carrying, you know, 15 kilos of rice up, back and forth fast, because you have to be very efficient, because you have to feed 7,000 people, you have to be very fast. So carrying 15 kilos of dal, of rice, wasn't very easy. And you bend till you serve the whole row of 20 people. And you go to the end of the row, you just, your back has to really feel, you really feel you've done something. You get a real, you go into a lunch and you become straight. But you don't really bother that. You take the another row comes and you again, you start serving. You don't really mind all the inconvenience. So for practically, and they were, every devotee was standing there. And it is a very vivid memory in my mind. There are everyone wanting to be a part of the service. And there are some devotees who gave their names late or because they wanted some 450 devotees or something like that. And there was the whole yatra was there. And the Jali of Fogla Ashram, and there were a lot of bunch of them outside who couldn't get the service. And they were like morose and looking and said, oh, I wish I was inside this Jali to be a part of this service. I'm just standing outside. They're getting all the nectar of service. They're standing, I'm such a useless fellow. Just thinking, hey, somebody will drop out. Somebody get a malaria fever. Somebody gets a backache. Somebody gets some leg ache or somebody gets a, you know, trauma on his leg and gets a wound and he'll be disqualified. And I can, on the waiting list, I can enter into that, you know. Waiting hope against hope. So there was so much exhilaration to be able to offer this service. So devotees were enjoying being servants of Srila Prabhupada's disciples and the Brijbhasis. And in the end, the vital question was asked. The key question was asked. The most pertinent question was asked. Said, who enjoyed more? Talking about enjoyment today. Who enjoyed more? Those who were eating the pakwan. And there were such exotic sweets made by those fancy devotees, cooks. Prabhupada's disciples is the biggest festival in ISKCON. for all times to come. And therefore, everything is first class. You have this, kala jam and all these things were there. Very exotic sweets. Said, who enjoyed more? Those who were actually being served with all those pakwans, or the ones who were actually doing the service of offering the pakwans? And the unanimous answer was, the servers enjoyed more than the guys who were eating. That was the sentiment of everybody's heart. And that was a great lesson to learn, that we would rather not sit in the pangat and eat that food, that nice prasadam, but rather we would be on the opposite side doing that offering of seva. Because there is more pleasure in serving than actually enjoying. So that was a powerful lesson which was taught to all of us. And that lesson is something which we can carry forward in our hearts at all times, that for a devotee, the greatest joys of life are only there when you get a chance to serve. And the greatest regrets in life, the greatest sorrows of life, are that time when we lose the opportunity to serve. I also remember Yadana Swami is one another nice instructive pastime, that we were at Pune, and at one particular year of Pune, and all of you know that he has a bad throat. He has a lot of acid reflux from his stomach, and his throat is almost always sore, and sometimes he cannot sing or talk like that. So he was singing. It was the night time, and everyone is eagerly waiting for that exclusive moment of sitting together and chanting candlelight kirtan. And his voice was just not emanating. He just could not speak anything, could not even sing. And he was so upset with that. He was so terribly upset. He said, I'm not able to render service to the devotees of engaging them in Harinam. That was the regret. So, these great souls, through their personal examples, they teach many, many important instructions. And today from Jadabharat Maharaj, we can definitely learn that in order to annihilate our false ego, which is the root cause of our anchorage into this material world, we will not be able to transcend to the spiritual sky till we are anchored by our false ego. And the most expedient means of getting rid of false ego is to cultivate diligently this quality of being a servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna's dear servants. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Padaki Jai.